The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, May the 24th, 2019. On the podcast today, I have Aidan Bishop, founder of Big Dish, D-I-S-H, ticker there. And Aidan discusses the new locations being rolled out as part of their expanded growth strategy. Also on the podcast, Dr. Graham Lumsden, CEO of Motif Bio, MTFB, and Graham provides an operational update on key aspects of his business and their growth strategy. Also on the podcast, Giulio Cironi, CEO, and Grant Nash, CFO of IXICO, that's I-X-I, ticker, and the guys discuss their growth as reflected in their interim results and also suggest more is to come. Also, Russ Mould, investment director at stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about Theresa May, who has announced she's stepping down on June the 7th, of course, the US-China trade dispute, and the following stocks: SNU, ZAR, and Standard Life Aberdeen, that's SLA. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs. And if you want to see top 10 versions of these lists, go to voxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll see lots of other content. And by the way, do us a favour. If you use the Vox Markets app, if you don't, you should do, and you get some value from it. It's free, of course, to download, but if you get value from it, then please return the favour by giving us a rating and review on your local app store. I say local, of course, it'd be anywhere in the world, but that would be much appreciated.
To receive free company updates straight to the front screen of your smartphone whenever a company you follow releases significant news, download the free Vox Markets app from voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Aidan Bishop, founder of Big Dish. Ticker there is D-I-S-H. Of course, Dish. Aidan, thanks for joining me.
You're welcome.
You're certainly not standing still, are you? You're releasing news on a regular basis, which is good. This is rollout of the app, different locations, and you've got new locations on Big Dish, and also a bit of a teaser there from Sanj Nahal's CEO, and we'll get into that in a bit. As always, though, Aidan, if anyone's new to this podcast or are not familiar with Big Dish, can you just explain, how does Big Dish work? What is it?
Yeah, Big Dish is the go-to platform, becoming the go-to platform in the UK for diners that want to be able to book a restaurant table and get a discount of 25% off, 50% off, or 2-for-1 on their food. And for restaurants, the proposition is that we allow restaurants to put excess inventory onto our platform, so to drive traffic, particularly at off-peak times. So every seat on Big Dish has a discount associated with it. It's a time-based discount.
Yeah, and the food industry and restaurant industry is very dynamic. I mean, this week, for example, you've had, I think, Pret announcing they're buying up Eat, which and they're going to change that into vegan, a vegetarian offering. Jamie Oliver's restaurants have gone into administration. He pumped a lot of cash in there. And do you know what? I don't know what Jory. I've got to say, first and foremost, I've never been to Jamie's restaurant, but I've had people go there, and I was surprised that the feedback from that wasn't very good. And I thought, there's a guy who stands on TV, talks about quality food, local produce, and all this stuff, and it seems his brand or that kind of restaurant there didn't really reflect that. I don't know what's your thoughts on that? Because obviously you're in this space, isn't it? I mean, Aidan, do you have any thoughts on it, by the way?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's obviously in the restaurant sector, everybody's talking about the demise of the Jamie Oliver's restaurants and all the subsequent job losses, of course, which is, you know, quite sad. But I think there's a number of reasons why, and it's not just Jamie Oliver's brand. The restaurant industry, particularly the chains, have been growing really much due to a private equity type of grow at all cost models. So private equity has been pumping money in, you know, demanding growth of these chains. And for many parts, as we're seeing now, it hasn't really worked, and you know the wheels are coming off for a lot of these brands, and you know I think that's one of the reasons. Another one of the reasons is probably due to the fact of changing consumer tastes and habits. I think, you know, in particularly in terms of Jamie Oliver's restaurants, there's a number of comments and articles in the press that reflect that there's a number of reviews that aren't too good on TripAdvisor, questions over the quality of the food and so forth. And so I think, you know, consumer tastes are changing, and it's a great time to be an independent restaurant or a small group, because these small groups and independents are much more nimble. They're able to provide a more personalized experience, and they're able to adjust to consumer trends and tastes a lot quicker than some of these big chains.
Yeah, yeah. Well, do you know what? I mean, your app, actually, I saw someone saying this and say this is a good opportunity for local sort of restaurants, family run restaurants that, you know, trade on reputation and quality to really stand out. And I noticed on the app, actually, in the sort of my area, Southampton, the restaurants on there seem to be, they're not chains, are they? They are sort of local, sort of family sort of businesses, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. And so we've deliberately done that. We've deliberately gone for the independents and the smaller restaurants. And the reason for doing that is because a lot of these restaurants feel that they've been neglected, that all tech companies and so forth go after the chains. And, you know, we've been able to really provide a pitch to these small restaurants and independent restaurants. Look, Big Dish is on your side. We want to help you. And it's working.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, let's get into the news. So you've announced you're rolling out new locations. Take us through that, if you could, please, Aidan.
Yeah, well, Swindon's gone live, which is good. So the way we onboard a new location is, well, there's a couple of ways we do it. Sometimes you want to build up a lot of restaurants and then take the location live. And sometimes you just want to do it. And what Sandra's been doing is electing just to get a couple of restaurants on board. And it just aids the business development in that particular town or city. So Swindon's gone live. Taunton is going live around Tuesday. We announced previously about Winchester. We've elected to go for Reading before Winchester, as we're starting to target these London commuter towns. So Reading will be coming soon. And of course, we have said that we're going to make an announcement next week regarding a couple of things, our plans within the UK, and also some details around an exciting partnership that will coincide with our launch in Brighton. We're quite excited about Brighton. We think Brighton's going to be big for us, a big food culture down there in Brighton.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I've got a friend who, when I used to live in London, he sort of rented a room off me, but he had a place in Brighton there, and he never stayed in London for the weekend. He loved Brighton, and he said, you know, so he's a bit of a foodie, and he used to go out to, and whatever, I can't think of the restaurant there, but sushi based restaurant, I think it was, but he used to love it. And he mentioned that, he always used to mention that scene down there. The restaurant scene is very good in Brighton. So that is, yeah, so I like that. So Sam says here, we look forward to updating the market next week on further significant plans regarding our rollout across the UK and the new partnership, which will coincide with the launch in Brighton. So that's a nice tease. Anything else you can give on that?
No.
The market's obviously liking the tease because the share price is up, but that is very interesting. So as far as you mentioned there, you deliberately avoided chains and stuff, and you look for locally owned independents. And will that continue or not?
We're not necessarily. I mean, look, we are going to have chains. There's no doubt about that. But what you don't want to do is you don't want to build a platform that has just, you know, five or half a dozen chains, because then you're going to be, you know, known as, oh, this is that, oh, it's just Pizza Express, it's just this one, it's just that one. What people want is a selection. They want things that they can't normally get from other platforms. So we are looking at getting independent small groups as the foundation across the UK of Big Dish. Now then we will add the chains, we will add the groups, but we want to do it once we've got a great foundation of independents and small groups and hotel restaurants, and, you know, pub restaurants are becoming, interestingly enough, I was reading a great article around pubs, and in 2007 in the UK, when the smoking ban came in and cheap booze in the supermarkets, it was affecting the pubs, and number of pubs closed, and pubs responded and changed, and now there's more food being served in pubs than ever before. So we're also looking at that and thinking about that, and we'll be targeting pub restaurants as well.
Yeah, absolutely cool, excellent stuff. And so I mean, as far as you're concerned here, I mean, is it going to plan? Is what you're doing, you know, are you quite happy with the way it's going?
Yeah, no, look, we're excited about how it's going. It's really exciting time. I think with any kind of young, you know, startup type of company, it's always you've got to keep pushing, you've got to keep fighting, you know, to grow, to keep going. But it's so we've got a lot of energy at Big Dish. We have a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of energy, and it is working. We are seeing it is definitely working. So we just got to keep doing it. We've got to take this nationwide and beyond. And, you know, we've got to keep being innovative around our tech. That's the key that underpins everything. You know, we keep doing all those things right. It's going to be big. It's going to be big. I think it is.
Cool. It's good to hear. Marvellous. As always then, Aidan, for people listening right now, liking the sound of this, but are not yet following the story, give us three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and Vox, which means they'll get the news and everything straight to the front screen of their smartphone. Well, they should do that. And add you to their watch list, please.
I think people should follow us from wherever they might be in the UK today, because Big Dish is coming there at some point soon over the coming months. And, you know, be part of it. Become a Big Dish user. There you go. That's a good reason.
Don't forget to mention, you know, private investors like that. You do hold have some skin in the game as well. It's worth mentioning that, isn't it?
Yeah, no, look, I'm the biggest shareholder of the company, and so look, I'm super motivated to make this a big success.
Yeah, absolutely, Aidan. Good to chat to you, and like I say, lots going on, always rolling out news, and as you are across the country with your app, so no doubt we'll be catching up in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Sure, thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Dr. Graham Lumsden, Chief Executive Officer of Motif Bio. That's MTFB ticker. Graham, thanks for joining me.
You're very welcome, Justin. Good to talk.
I was stunned to look at the last time we talked. I mean, it was back last year, end of the summer last year. And I don't know why, you've obviously been on my mind more than that, Graham. But I know I've talked about Motif with Vadim Alexander at SP Angel. So maybe that's what it is. But it's surprising. Time flies, I suppose. So, Graham, let's just remind people the top line summary before we get into more detail. Motif Bio, what's it all about, please?
Yes, Motif Bio, we are focused on developing a new antibiotic, which is called Icoprim, which is particularly well-suited to patients in hospital who have some of these infections caused by multidrug-resistant bacteria. And we are in the final stages of regulatory review with Icoprim, seeking to get on the market and develop from there. A very well-differentiated antibiotic. And we have a lot of news to update you on.
Yeah, I was going to say, where do we start? So take us through, significant points of, the journey since we last spoke, please, if you could, Graham.
Perfect, yes. So we took the opportunity yesterday to distribute a press release just to work through all the work that's been going on behind the scenes. We started off just reminding everybody that we did have a meeting with the FDA on May the 3rd, and the reason for that so-called Type A meeting was to discuss a path forward for Icoprim for the treatment of acute bacterial skin and skin structure infections. And that meeting took place because unexpectedly we received a complete response letter in February from the FDA, where they indicated that they had some concerns about potential liver toxicity. So we met with them on May 3rd, had a discussion about that. After we left the Taipei meeting, we believe that the FDA individuals reconvened, got together, and we expect them to tell us approximately 30 days following May 3rd, so most likely around the beginning of June, what they've decided they want us to do in order to get Icoprim back on track and get approval for acute bacterial skin and skin structure infections. So as I say, we had the meeting, there was a discussion, no decisions. The FDA individuals reconvene, figure out what they want us to do, and they'll let us know with the formal meeting minutes with some decisions around how they would like us to proceed. So obviously, as soon as we receive that, we will indicate to the market what the FDA is suggesting we do. Now, as we previously disclosed in February, February the 14th, at the time of receiving the complete response letter, the FDA indicated that additional data likely would be required to address their concern about a risk of liver toxicity. So as soon as we understand exactly what they mean by additional data, which we expect to get in these formal meeting minutes, we'll be able to talk about that to investors.
Okay, and what do you do up until then? And have you considered the outcomes and the plan going forward from that?
Yes, so as we think about the path forward for acute bacterial skin and skin structure infections, we really believe that Iclaprim has broad potential as a well-differentiated and targeted anti-infective agent. We now have experience and data on safety and efficacy from Iclaprim use in nearly 1,500 individuals. And we can see that there's an important unmet medical and indeed health economic need that Iclaprim may be able to fulfill within this hospital-based antibiotic landscape. So you have seen some press releases in the last several months where we continue to present new Iclaprim data. So in April, we presented data at a big European conference called ECCMID. And we just announced a couple of days ago that we will be presenting three posters at the so-called ASM Microbe Conference, which is in San Francisco next month. And, you know, we continue to be encouraged by the reception we're getting from the infectious disease specialists regarding the potential of Iclaprim. The important thing, I think, is in addition to all of that, we have been for several months now indicating that we intend to partner Iclaprim upon marketing approval. Whilst we have Iclaprim as our lead asset, we can see that it just doesn't make sense to try and build a sales and marketing organization around a single asset. It's a very expensive thing to do. If you have more than one asset, it certainly could make sense. So as soon as we have an approval for Iclaprim, the intention is to have a commercialization partner in the United States and in other major geographies around the world. So that means it's appropriate to focus on our strengths above and beyond Iclaprim and acute bacterial skin and skin structure infections. And we think our strengths lie clearly in having a management team that has shown that they can do late stage clinical development. We successfully completed two phase three trials. We called them the REVIVE clinical trials. And so we've continued to do things like expand our patent portfolio. We had announced last year that we got a new patent, which gives us exclusivity out until 2036 in the United States. And those patents are being filed in other geographies to expand our footprint globally. That's very important from a partnering perspective. And then the two key things probably that would be interesting to investors today, you know, we're a biotechnology company. We have Iclaprim as our lead asset. We think it's a really, really good asset. But as a biotechnology company, we've had an ongoing business development effort for some considerable time now. And two announcements that we've done in the last 3 weeks are, I think, very good examples of where our business development activities can get us. So the first one, we announced about 3 weeks ago that we have signed an agreement with a UK-based company called Lamellar Biomedical. And Lamellar Biomedical has a number of interesting programs in their portfolio, one of which is focused on cystic fibrosis. And you may remember that Motif Bio has an orphan designation for Iclaprim in the treatment of Staph aureus pneumonia in cystic fibrosis. So the agreement we've signed with Lamellar says that if we combine Iclaprim with their product, which is called LMS-611, we think there will be potentiated or enhanced effects of Iclaprim in clearing bacteria in the lungs of patients with cystic fibrosis. So the first step is an animal study that is about to get underway, combining Iclaprim with Lamellar's LMS-611. The second one, which we think is pretty interesting, we just announced yesterday actually, is an agreement with a university in Germany, in Magdeburg. It's called the Otto von Guericke University. And they are experts and, in fact, have a model that studies a very rare disease called toxoplasma chorioretinitis. So this is a parasitic infection which causes blindness. And we have evidence that eclipram has activity against toxoplasma. And so this German university is exploring eclipram in their model to confirm whether it could be a useful treatment for this rare cause of blindness. So there's two examples that we've announced just in the last few weeks, which are examples of our ongoing business development efforts.
Yeah, so when you got that, you know, a complete response letter from the FDA in February, I mean, the share price obviously reacted negatively, fell off a cliff, and a lot of people think it was just basically a binary decision. But that's not the case, is there? There's commerciality opportunities, you know, quite significant ahead still, isn't there?
Yes, we don't see it as binary at all. I mean, I think it's pretty clear to us that there is a path forward for eclipram and acute bacterial skin and skin structure infections. We have to wait these formal meeting minutes to find out whether it's a straightforward path or whether it's a slightly more challenging path forward. But we do fundamentally believe that there's a path forward for eclipram for acute bacterial skin and skin structure infections. So we've been laser focused on that. We continue to be laser focused on that. We have a great team internally. We've been working with some tremendous external experts, and we continue to see that as adding value for shareholders. In addition to that, we have announced those two things that I just went through that shows that there can be incremental value around the eclipram asset. And indeed, we're looking at other potential paths to continue to build value for shareholders.
Okay, thanks, Graham. Excellent stuff. Okay, and you're aware of this, so I'm going to ask you now for three reasons, and this is for people listening who are not following the story, but like the sound of the progress you're making. Give them three quick reasons in summary why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Right. Number one, we have a new well-differentiated antibiotic, which is in the final stages of regulatory review. And I think many people are reading very frequently about the need for new antibiotics because of these so-called superbugs that are developing resistance to existing antibiotics. Number two, we recently announced incremental value programs focused on cystic fibrosis, an orphan indication, and toxoplasma chorioretinitis. So ways to build incremental value around our lead asset, eclipram. And thirdly, we have ongoing business development programs to build additional shareholder value through partnering and through pipeline expansion. So I think those would be the three key reasons, Justin.
Excellent stuff. Well, hopefully, Graham, you know, we won't be strangers so much in the future as we have been in the last 6-7 months, but hopefully we'll catch up again. But good to chat to you, and look forward to speaking again in the not-too-distant future.
Great. Thanks so much, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Giulio Cironi, CEO, and Grant Nash, CFO of IXICO. And the ticker there is IXI. Guys, thanks for joining me.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I've got to say, you have been on my watch list. I've been reading your updates, and I saw your recent update of your results. So I'm quite interested to get you guys on and you know, have it from the horse's mouth kind of thing. And but people now are listening are probably not familiar with the company, or some maybe. But if people are listening now, they're not sure about the company, never heard you before. Can you summarise? What is IXICO all about, please?
Sure. So IXICO is a London-based a high-tech company, basically analyzing brain scans that are used in clinical trials by the pharmaceutical industry. And we've built a very strong position serving pharmaceutical companies all over the world. Over 91% of our revenues are outside the UK, so we're a very international company. And we work with all the big pharma companies and many of the new emerging biotech companies in this space as well.
Excellent stuff. Okay, well, let's get into your recent news, then, because you had your results out, and it seems improvements on many metrics here. So it's half year report, of course. Take us through some of the highlights, if you could.
Grant. Yeah, sure. So it's been a really strong first half year for IXICO. Revenue growth has been greater than 20% again for the fifth period in a row, up at 3.4 million compared to the same period last year. It's also worth highlighting that in the first half of this 2019 year, IXICO has done as much revenue as it did in the full financial year 2016. So you can see there's been not only rapid growth in the last year, but over a period of time. And what I think is worth highlighting is that hasn't come at the expense of gross margins. Gross margins have also been accreting across that period as well, from the 40% up to 66% for the first half year. And what that means is that the organization has, for the first time since it listed back in 2013, achieved break-even EBITDA across a half-year period. That is clearly a great first half-year result that actually puts the organization in a position where it can continue to deliver against expectations, but also enables it to invest in growing its top line on a continued basis going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's worth putting this in context, of course, because your valuation at the moment is what? Around about, what, it's sub 13 million, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah. So we think there's definitely room for some significant upside here.
Yes.
Yeah. And the other thing to add here as well is, in addition to the performance of the business, the underlying growth of the business, we also did a very successful fundraise last year. So we actually raised over £5.5 million. So we've got a very strong cash position, around about £7.5 million of cash, which is obviously going to be deployed in the coming periods to further accelerate the growth and support the growth. We're going to be spending that money in building our commercial team, investing more in our AI algorithms that are being used to do the analytics, and also generally just the whole scale up of the organization so that we can do more projects and bigger projects for the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah. Well, listen, it looks like you're growing at a good rate here. And you know, your order book going forward is very strong, to just 21.2 million. Give us the comparables on that. What was that like to this time last year?
It was just north of 14 million last year. If we go back to sort of the year before, we were in sort of 12 million sort of range. So that order book is significantly bigger than it's ever been. And what it means is it is an order book of contracted orders, and the contracts that we have are multi-year contracts. So they average in range of value of anything between £500,000 and £9 million. And so what it means is, from the pharmaceutical industry, so obviously they need to contract people like ourselves with our mission critical services for them. And it means that we've got great visibility to future revenues. I would highlight as well, though, that that number, you know, was flattered by a very significant contract that we won and announced in September. That was a £9.1 million contract to be delivered over a four-year period. That contract has been contributed to some of the growth in the first half of this year, but that actually is going to contribute at an accelerating pace in the second half of this year and going into next year as well. So we're very well set up to continue the growth rates that we've demonstrated in the first half. And our business development team, which we, as I said, are looking to invest and expand, are clearly now looking to further increase the pipeline so that we can keep on building that order book.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, companies can sort of improve their revenue, but their margins deteriorate. But your margins haven't. They've improved, haven't they?
Absolutely. I mean, we at the end of last year, for our fiscal year finishes in September, we were at 59%, which is a big improvement over the prior year on our margin. And in this 6 months now, we've reported 66%. So, you know, 22% top-line growth. Very significant margin accretion in that 6 months of over 600 base points. And the other thing is, the order book also has increased by 10%, because the other thing is, of course, you know, sometimes you can have a great top line, but you're actually depleting your order book. We're actually not doing that. We're growing at 22% and increasing the order book further 10% and increasing the margins by 600 base points.
Okay, so the question is, how are you doing it? And I mean, the order book looking going forward is looking good, like you say, even notwithstanding that big chunk. So, and how are you doing this? And, you know, do you expect this to continue?
Yeah, so how are we doing this? I mean, I've been here now, I joined in February 17. And it's really very, very much about focusing the great science and the great innovation and capabilities around analytics that the company has. It's all about focusing the organization on serving the pharmaceutical industry. It's a blue chip customer base. Obviously, they have a very high need to be innovative and develop new drugs. And the other thing I should say as well is our particular focus is in neuroscience. So we focused our business on neuroscience. So these are, you'll have heard a lot in the news around Alzheimer's and dementias, mm-hmm. Parkinson's, MS. These are sorts of disease areas that we're supporting our clients with. There's lots of, there's hugely, you know, a huge unmet medical need. We focused our resources in helping develop new approaches in these clinical trials. And that's what we're doing. And our core, if you like, secret sauce is our ability to develop innovative algorithms. We're trusted by the pharmaceutical industry that our technology is proven. It's been adopted across the world over several years. So they don't see us as a startup. We've got very deep relationships with academia. Our technology and our the base of what we do has been published in scientific papers over 500 times over the last decade. So we're well trusted by the customers, and we are basically just continually ramping up our offerings. And so one of the things that's been key is we historically started in Alzheimer's, and in the last 2 years we've been basically using those capabilities and applying them into new therapeutic areas. And one particular strong area for us in the last 18 months has been Huntington's. Been a lot of innovation in Huntington's. And so the algorithms that we've developed are really helping us build a leading position in that therapeutic area. And also other areas that are of interest to the pharmaceutical industry. There's a lot of focus on rare diseases. And again, our algorithms and our ability to develop very specialized analytical techniques on brain images is really helping us build a very strong position in the market.
Yeah, and just go through, just summarize again, so exactly what you do. So you have clients, big sort of clients and small clients, and tell us what you do there.
Yeah, so there are around about 14 pharmaceutical companies. If you take the top 14 pharmaceutical companies by R&D spend, 8 of those are clients of ours. And what we do for them is basically they have to find the right sort of patients to come onto a clinical trial, for example, for Huntington's. They have to then make sure that those clients that they give their potential new drug to, that they're safe during that clinical trial. And also what they're trying to monitor is that, you know, whether that trial is having a beneficial effect on the patient. You know, is it stopping the progression of the disease, for example? So that's the problem that they are trying to address. And medical brain scans and MRI scans, again, people have heard about MRI scans, mm-hmm. Are increasingly being seen as very valuable ways of being able to monitor changes in the brain structure. And different parts of the brain structure are looked at for the different neurological diseases. And so what we do is we take those brain images and we then apply our proprietary algorithms onto those. And so rather than relying on the human eye and expertise and experience, which can also be, of course, variable between one person and another, mm-hmm. we're using automated algorithms to do that interpretation. And as a result of having done this now for over a decade, we've analyzed over 100,000 MRI scans. And that means that our algorithms have got better and better as they've done more and more of that analysis. And that's why we're seen as a very strong, unique partner to our pharmaceutical clients.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so, and as far as, you know, operationally, milestones, news coming up, or what's new coming up then?
Yeah, so first of all, as I said, what people can expect is that they see that the continued momentum in the top line because of the very strong order book and the commercial traction that we have on the development side. The pharmaceutical industry is becoming increasingly interested in wearables and how they could potentially help monitor what are called digital biomarkers rather than imaging biomarkers. So imaging biomarkers, they use MRI scans to do that. And so the sort of thing that being looked at here is the idea of using a wearable and instead of people having to go to a clinic, actually being able to monitor people in their home or at work and looking. So, for example, somebody suffering from Parkinson actually also suffers from sleep disorders. And if there's a way of monitoring sleep patterns, that could be a valuable adjunct to the data that is being collected on a patient on a clinical trial. And so we're working with some pharmaceutical companies in developing algorithms that can help them monitor those sorts of markers. We're not developing or manufacturing the wearables. Our focus is on the algorithms and the software that are used to do the analytics. Okay. And so we expect to announce some collaborations and hopefully some new commercial initiatives over the next 12 to 18 months. We're very excited about that because it clearly builds on the core competences that we have in data management and data analysis.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Okay, guys. Well, if someone's listening to this, likes the sound of what you're doing and the progress you're making, but are not yet following the story, could you give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please?
Sure, absolutely. Well, the first thing is, yeah, we're operating in an attractive market. You know, we're all getting older. We all hope to be living longer. And what that means is with an aging population, that neurological disease is going to become a bigger issue. The way I try to capture that is by saying, yeah, if we get into our 80s, roughly half of us are going to suffer from some sort of neurological disorder, and the other half are going to be looking after us. So it's going to affect all of us. So everybody's very focused on this. Governments are focused on it. Pharmaceutical companies are, and also people like, you know, the Bill Gates of this world and others are putting money into trying to find new medicines for what is probably the biggest and largest unmet medical need on the planet today. So that's the first thing. Secondly, we've obviously got traction. We've been doing really well for the last five reported periods, as Grant talked to. But also, we are confident of maintaining that momentum given the order book that we have. And then finally, we are very well capitalized. So we have, as I said, £7.5 million of cash. So we are well resourced to fund the investments and growth that we've mentioned. And we're debt free. So we're in a very, very strong position. We're very excited about the ambitious growth targets we set ourselves. And we have the means to do what needs to be done.
Excellent stuff. Giulio and Grant, good to chat to you. And hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at Stockbroker AJ Bell. You all right, Russ?
I'm very well, Justin. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Good.
And, as we speak, I'm just waiting. Apparently, they've set up a lectern outside their number 10 Downing Street.
Oh, dear. Not a gallows, then.
No, exactly.
Might as well, or a guillotine. It might as well be.
Yeah, I feel a bit sorry for her, but part of it's her doing, and apparently, she's not open to talks and negotiation, very hard, strong-headed. And I didn't see that documentary. I heard a political person say that Channel 4 documentary behind the scenes of Brexit, and Guy Verhofstadt, or whatever his name, and
Guy Verhofstadt, yeah.
And Juncker, apparently, they were open to an easier, better deal, but they weren't even pushed on it, apparently.
So, no, I think it was a very difficult job that she's made look even more difficult than it possibly could have been. But I'm just glad I'm not in her kit and heels, basically. And I'm frankly sure all of your listeners are as well. It's not me running the country, God forbid.
Talking about negotiations and trade deals and all this stuff. Did you see that today? Trump apparently said that Huawei could be part of the trade deal. So he called it illegal and almost a spy network. And now he's saying, well, we can work that into the trade deal.
Yeah, well, he's also been bragging about all the tax income that America's generating, which I don't think is strictly true, because that's then the costs are being borne by US consumers. Yeah. And he's also just written a check for $16 billion for American farmers. So it's money in with one hand and out the other. So I think all that backs up my view is that there are no winners here. There may be some winners, but there will be losers net. I'm not sure you're any better off because, Senator Chuck Grassley in Iowa has been complaining loudly that farmers in his state, he's going to defend his people. But, pig and corn and wheat farmers in Iowa are getting absolutely killed by this. And now Trump's realised he's actually handing them $16 billion to try and keep them in the game. It's a very, very complicated. There are no simple solutions. And again, I have every sympathy with what Trump is trying to do in terms of this issue of intellectual property and theft and protection of rights. I think that's incredibly important. And I obviously understand he feels the need to carry a big stick and talk loudly, but I don't think tariffs are the right tool. In the end, there are going to be winners, but there are going to be losers. You know, we've quoted it before. There's the American University of Dartmouth study, the steel tariffs that he put on Canada and Mexico, which he's now removed, of course, just this week as well, in a further step backwards. That was protecting 165,000 US steel workers. But 140,000 or 150,000, but 6.5 million Americans working in industries that consume steel, which was going to be made more expensive, and their jobs were going to be made more difficult and potentially jeopardized. So, you know, this is the fascinating thing about economics. It's all about choice.
Yeah. Do you know what? Breaking news here. But well, it depends on when you listen to the podcast. Of course, it probably won't be. But Theresa May has quit Conservative leader on the 7th of June.
Paving the way. The day after D-Day. There you go.
Yeah.
Is that the week of what was supposed to be the fourth meaningful vote or whatever it was?
Yes. Meaningless vote.
Meaningless vote, exactly.
But just one final thing on Trump. But I was watching CNBC yesterday and they were saying that essentially the market is 5% away from a high, which is a tweet from Trump, or 5% it moves on his tweets, which is ridiculous, really. You know?
Yeah, so, it is. People should just not listen, basically. Yeah, exactly. You know, but yeah, I mean, this is the interesting thing. The US is, for all of the flap doodle that we've had over the past 2 or 3 months, it is still just 5% away from its highs. But I'll give you a counter argument to that. Mm-hmm. We've got an accommodative Fed. Yeah. We've got a strong US economy. We've got a president who's doing his best to goose the market whenever he can and deliver it. We've in theory got strong US earnings. And yet the S&P 500 is no higher now than it was in January 2018.
Yeah, we're at the top somewhere, aren't we?
You're the chartist, my friend, more than me. But I'm pretty sure you could make a case for there being a triple top on that chart so felt the need.
Absolutely. And, but it takes longer than we think sometimes. You know, it can take 6-12 months before you actually
It's the old story, you know, market tops are a process. Because obviously the battle between bulls and bears is, you know, the bulls aren't going to give up easily, right? They've just had it off for 10 years.
Yeah.
So they aren't just going to say, oh, yeah, you know what, we've had a good run, let's just let it all go. So I think, you know, you can see why, you know, what's a fascinating test is Tesla. I know it's only one stock out of X thousand in the US and X tens of thousands in the world, but that stock's gone below $200. Its debt is trading at 82 cents on the dollar, and the convertible it's just issued has gone down to about 92. It's only been trading for a fortnight. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those companies that has, you know, typified in many ways, exemplified the wider market. And it's one of those companies that's been adding customers, boosting sales, and has never really given any indication when it's going to sustainably make a profit. And there's oodles of those companies out there, and we know who they are. And, you know, we know that they've got meaty valuations. They've done an awful lot to lead this market higher. Or if they've got profits, they're pretty scanty and their cash flow is very weak. And so it'd be interesting if this one does crater, and it might not. But if it does that mean people start re-examining some of the other names that have got similar cash flow, profit, never, never type profiles and similarly chunky valuations? We shall see.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's. Let's look at some individual stocks, Sir Russ.
Yeah, back to two UK small caps. One, yeah. Both that we've looked at before with varying degrees of success. S&U and Czar. Okay. And then on income, we'll have a look at Standard Life Aberdeen this week.
Marvellous. Okay, S&U, what's happening there?
S-U-S is the ticker. It's a small cap. Market cap is about £265 million. And we looked at it a couple of months ago. Mm-hmm. And it's a motor finance and specialist lender. So Advantage does subprime car lending. And Aspen does property loans for commercial buildings where the borrowers refurbish them, buy them or whatever. Now, these are niche areas. The big banks aren't playing. And it clearly has its risks, right? But this is a family founded company, still family run, 80-year history. It does things pretty carefully. And we've just had an AGM and trading update coming out. Now, even if you're not interested in the company, because it doesn't fit with your risk profile, it's very interesting because, let's face it, if there is going to be economic trouble in the UK, I'd imagine this is the sort of company that might get a sense of what's going on first. Does that make sense? Because you can see in the US, credit card and subprime auto and subprime housing delinquencies are creeping back up again. Yeah. Actually, in some cases, back to 2009 levels, rather frightening, when again, in theory, everything's going very well. But this company, trading update, I think it's reaffirmed its credentials as doing this pretty prudently. Advantage customer base have set a new record. strong applications, but they're sticking to quality. Their collections are up 6% year on year, so they're not just spraying money out of hand. And their impairments have gone down, which I think is a big tick. And the Aspen loan bridging, the Aspen bridging building business, loan book's gone up 4 million from 18 to 22 million. That's going well. They're well within their headroom, but I think it was customers up, impairments down that caught my eye. Good for the stock. Hopefully a reasonable sign for the economy. And the stock's on a forward PE of 9 with a yield of over 5%. So a little bit of both there, potentially for capital and income.
Yeah, the nice bounce on the 16th, 17th of April, which is when the news was out. So it bounced from sort of £18.
Yeah, that was the yeah.
Up to over 20 quid. So yeah, nice. It's looking good. Back on track, it looks like.
Touch wood. Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think share price got marmalised last year because people were terrified what was going to happen to the UK economy. You know, post Brexit, pre Brexit, whatever. And I think that was the big cloud on the stock. But I think they've proved so far that, you know, they can lend sensibly and do their bit and not, you know, find that people, you know, to whom they've given the money can't give it back.
Yeah, cool. Okay, Czar.
Next. Never catch a falling knife is one of those stock market maxims that value seekers try and occasionally take on. And I first looked at it after its first profit warning, summer 18, thinking there's a massive net cash pile here, leading technology. This thing will eventually turn around, and it may well do so, but the share price is now 90p, and they've chucked out two more profit warnings, and that cash pile is going down very quickly. So they've announced another loss. The analysts have now got them making a loss for the next 2 years, so that's going to do even more damage to the cash pile. And the company said that it now, quote, needs a strategic partner so it can maximise the value of its digital inkjet printing technology. Now, going back to Theresa May and negotiating positions, making that public is probably not the strongest bargaining position that you've ever given yourself. So I think I'm just going to have to withdraw gracefully. I still believe in the technology, but the net cash pile is going down. And clearly the legacy ceramics business is still shrinking a heck of a lot quicker than the new generation stuff's coming through. I'm sure it'll come through, but it sounds to me as if the company is either going to be coming up with a raise or a partnership that's going to probably dilute existing shareholders. So maybe we can come back and have a look when they've done that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sorry.
And do you know what? It's in a downward trend. It's showing no change in that trend yet. So
there was a bounce about 105p a couple of weeks ago, and then that just got chopped straight off at the knees. So
yeah. So I'd wait for a move above the 200-day moving average would see a thing, because that's a long way off yet. That's 150. Right. Okay. What's
the income? Standard Life Aberdeen SLA. It's a FTSE 100 company. £6.5 billion market cap. Now, it joined the market in 2007, and until 2018, had increased its dividend every single year, which is no mean feat. Now, the dividend, I think, was unchanged last year, about 21.3p, as the company digested the Aberdeen Asset Management acquisition. Remember, it sold the insurance business. It's now basically a pure play fund manager. And the stock's got a hammering for a number of different reasons. Its absolute return GARS funds have seen huge outflows. There was great skepticism over the Aberdeen Asset Management merger, as always happens when you've got assets that have got legs. Some of the assets walked out the door, which probably hasn't helped. And you've now got a company on a dividend yield of around 8 to 8.5%. And after the Vodafone dividend cut, the M&S dividend cut, the SSE dividend cut, a lot of people are getting windy looking at FTSE 100 companies with massive yields going, who's next?
Yeah.
And Standard Life Aberdeen, on the face of it, is right at the top of the list because earnings and cash flow don't fully cover the forecast dividend. But this is what's interesting. It's net cash. It's got a pension surplus. It's got distributable reserves of £1.6 billion, which compared to an annual dividend payment of just over £500 million. And it's got stakes in quoted companies in the UK and India worth £4.5 billion.
Mm.
So the actual core business, fund management business, has only been valued at 2.1, so there's a stub trade, some of the parts angle there, if anybody's really interested. But what it does seem to me to suggest, although the earnings and the cash flow numbers don't look good, there's enough cash in the kitty to see this dividend through for another year or two at least, until they can turn the ship around and get the fund flows going positive again. So let's see. I don't think there's going to be much by way of capital gain here, because I think unless you see huge GARS inflows or the market's going an absolute tear, I think that's going to be tricky. But for an income seeker, you might not be quite on the treacherous ground that you would immediately think, looking at, you know, an 8.5% dividend yield barely covered by earnings and cash flow.
But do you know what? The chart is looking good. Do you know what? The last chart we said it hasn't shown any signs of a turn in that trend. This has. It's a hit 2.20. It bounced there at a higher low at 2.30 about a month later in February this year. It then went above the 200-day moving average, which is at the bear bull line. It's come back a bit, but it's consolidating, and I think it could grind higher here. I mean, it stopped going down. That's what I'm saying.
Which is partly why it's come up on my screen. The other thing that interests me is that, you know, one of the things that a lot of analysts and hedge funds and algorithm look for is the second derivative. Yeah. It's not the rate of change, it's the rate of change in the rate of change. And yeah, although fund outflows, there are still fund outflows, they're getting smaller. So the second derivative is improving. Does that make sense? I think that's potentially one of the things that is at the moment at least giving support. So any fund outflows stabilise or go positive, then actually the stock could start really motoring. But I think, and that would obviously give much more confidence in the yield than the market's got right now. So that's going to be still a key number to watch when the company reports going forwards.
Do you know what? I hold an ETF, a dividend ETF.
And it's not your Turkish thing again, is it, that you were talking about the other way?
It's a UK dividend. It's FTSE 350. They have 50 stocks.
Yeah, another one.
And I just checked in to see if Standard Life is on there. It's got to be. Yeah, it's top of the list. It's the biggest weighting of 3.3% in that list. So there we are. So I've got exposure to that anyway. So I'm quite pleased. The chart is
okay.
And the fundamentals, like you say, are not too bad. They're all right at the moment. So they got cash anyway. So
that's the important thing. So you know, they probably do have a couple of years grace, and obviously if fund outflows remain horrendous in a couple of years' time, there could be a reassessment, but we'll see. Keith Skeo, the CEO, said unchanged dividends the master plan, but then so did the CEO of Vodafone, so we'll find out.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Have a nice bank holiday weekend.
Yes,
Russ,
have a lovely bank holiday weekend. I've got nothing planned, which is fantastic.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Thomas Cook Group. People still trading that, are they? I just said with that, you know, it's high risk, it's a trade, you could do very well, but, you know, you have to be prepared, if you're investing this overnight, to wake up one morning and maybe have the probability of saying your shares have been taken, or the company's been taken into administration. That's how close to the edge it is. That's why you can have some sort of, very volatile trading there. At four, Block Energy, BLOE, up 1.2%. At three, Integumin, that's skin, 8.15% up today. And I've done a couple of videos on that company. At two, Bidstack. Really, the message sinking in yesterday with James coming on the podcast and the potential that they have around the world. And at number one, it's New Formix, has done so well of late. NFX, it's got about 300% since the start of the year, and I've done videos on that as well. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, it's Starcom, Directorate Change. At four, Holdings in Company, Metal Tiger. What is that? 6.6%. Who is it? Michael Joseph. 6.6% there in Metal Tiger. At three, IMI Pharma, final results. At two, Sirius Minerals, notification of Mader Holdings. And at number one, it's Strategic Minerals, Cobre Client update, and they've got their client there is going to afford them, I think, pretty much pay them $4 million, I think, on arrears and all that stuff. But they've come to clarification on that, which is very good for those guys. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.